Welcome to episode 8 of season 18 of the Growing Empire Show. Today I'm here with my special guest, Mike Henninger. Mike is a CPA and has a real passion for helping real estate investors maximize their income. And as a part of that, he's made it his mission to make sure that investors are not overpaying on their taxes. From utilizing tax strategies like cost segregation studies and other avenues, Mike helps investors maximize their cash flow and their income. So today we're going to talk about cost segregation studies as one of those vehicles for tax savings. I hope you enjoy today's show.
Welcome to Growing Empires, hosted by real estate entrepreneur and trusted investment advisor, Jennifer DeJesus. Growing Empires provides insight to building wealth through passive income-producing real estate investments for those who want to build and manage a more profitable real estate portfolio.
Welcome, Mike, to the Growing Empire Show. I'm so glad that you're here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's kick off this episode with you telling a little bit about your background and the work that you're doing now.
Okay. Well, I was in the military years ago, a long time ago. I finished school a year after I had gotten out. And my first job, I was doing some accounts receivable work in a car dealership. I got into some financial planning. I got in with a software company where I was the accounting manager. And the whole time I dabbled in real estate. I had some rental properties. I had flipped some houses and rehabbed them. But I knew that I needed to be on my own at some point. So in 2003, I went out on my own, started my own firm, started doing a lot of tax prep, did mostly tax prep for a while. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, we started transitioning more into the tax planning advisory type work, because we were just finding that you can't really help anybody in tax season. You can't mitigate any tax burden once the taxes are due, right? So we started really kind of working with clients throughout the year, because I'm not a fan of how our money is spent. So if I can help people legally stick it to them, I want to do that, you know, and I want to utilize, and we have a saying where we want to use the tax code against the people that actually wrote it. And you can do that. You know, you don't have, there's a lot of tax evasion going on, but tax avoidance is, you know, if you're doing things, if you're using the code in a way that is legal, in a way that maximizes it to your advantage, you can turn the tax code into a cheat code, and you can do that without having to worry about having to, the IRS, you know, bang your door down with the newly purchased guns that they're allocated with the new funding they got.
Yeah. Well, today we're going to talk about cost segregation, and I have asked Mike to join me to share his wealth of knowledge that he's gained throughout the years on this subject. We're going to jump right in. So why don't you start by explaining what is cost segregation and how does it benefit real estate investors?
Sure. Under normal circumstances, when you buy a rental property, if it's residential or commercial, you have a set period of time that you're allowed to depreciate that asset. And that, and depreciation is basically, it's the process of recording the deterioration of an asset over what's considered its useful life, right? So if you have a residential property, the IRS says, look, we're going to give a life of 27 and a half years to that asset. We're going to say that, okay, that building's going to last 27 and a half years. If it's commercial, they change it to 39 years. So if you have a property that you're renting out to, you know, just a tenant as a residential property, you're able to take the purchase price of that asset, back out a portion for land, because land is not technically, it's not depreciable portion of that asset. And then the remainder you can depreciate over 27 and a half years. And that's, you know, that's great in the sense that it's basically a paper loss, because no matter if you funded that with, if you bought that property with cash or you bought that property with a loan, you're still able to take and the expense for depreciation against your income, whether or not and generally no cash went out the door for it. So it's kind of a paper expense, which is a great thing. And it's one of the exciting things about real estate and how people utilize it to build wealth long term. The problem, though, is that if you've ever had rental properties, there are a lot of parts of these buildings, residential and commercial, that are not going to last 27 and a half years. They're not going to last 39 years. So it's cost segregation. What that is it's basically a process where you bring in a company with an engineer or somebody like that, and you start looking at the property and say, okay, wait a minute. You know, those cabinets are not going to last 27 and a half years. They're probably going to last 5 or 7 years or something like that. And it basically allows you to carve out components of this asset and put them into shorter life buckets, 5, 7, and 15 years. And the reason that's important is because if you can take 30% of the asset and start depreciating it over a shorter period of time, you get a bigger chunk of that paper expense that we talked about in the beginning stages of that asset's life. And that allows you to have more control over, it doesn't allow you to eliminate taxes. It allows you to push them down the road a little bit and have more cash now to manipulate in your favor, right?
So in other words, cost segregation is going to speed up your depreciation, allowing you to keep mm-hmm. more money in your pocket versus the traditional 27 and a half years for residential and 39 years for commercial.
Correct. And you know, in the presentation we talked about, we took an asset and we said, okay, let's suppose you have this house that's $350,000. You pull out $75,000 for land, and that leaves you $275,000 of depreciable basis. So over 27 and a half years, that's going to be $10,000 a year, right? $275,000 divided by 27.5 gives you $10,000 of expense that you can write off against your rental income. And essentially, we did this example where, let's just suppose our net cash flow after paying operational expenses was 18 grand. What we're saying is you put $18,000 in your bank account and you only pay tax on eight because you had this paper law, this paper expense of $10,000. Once we use cost segregation, we carved out, you know, it varies obviously, but let's just say 30% of that purchase price. We were able to carve out 30% of that 275 and put it into those 5, 7, and 15 year buckets. And when we ran the numbers, we were able to wipe out all of that net income, which allowed you to basically put $18,000 in the bank account and pay tax on nothing. And that's, so yes, in other words, what it allows you to do is instead of waiting 27 and a half years to depreciate this entire asset, it allows you to take a bigger chunk of that now. And that allows you to keep more money in the bank, more money in the business, more money in your pocket, and allows you to use it in different avenues to possibly generate more revenue.
Okay. So what is the process? Like, what is the entire process from start to finish to do a cost segregation study?
Essentially, you would have, you know, you buy the property, and then you would hire a company that does cost segregation to come out there and basically give you an entire breakdown of all the components of that building, of that property. And within that, it gives you line by line what assets are 5 year, what assets are 7 year, what assets are 15. And then that's, you take that, and that's your depreciation schedule that when you're doing your taxes, you use those numbers to create the depreciation schedules within the tax return. And you can, and again, you can hire companies that do that. You can also use that. There's some DYI. I believe there's a DYI costseg.com or something, some company that actually does them where you provide them the information and they'll do it. I don't know if it's, I guess it's online. They have a whole system of how they do the cost segregation studies. And there's an upsell for audit protection. I always suggest getting the audit protection. And what happens then is if the IRS comes back and ever questions it, they'll actually send an engineer out and they'll do the full blown cost seg for no more. It's like $200 for the audit protection. So it kind of makes it worthwhile.
So what types of properties are best suited for cost seg studies?
Well, any type of rental property really would work. You know, I've seen them done on golf courses. I've seen them done on any type of asset that you pull depreciation on. But generally speaking, they can be oversold in the sense that if you can't utilize the losses, it doesn't make sense to actually go ahead and have the process done. And when we say can't utilize the losses, when we're talking about rental properties are considered passive, right? So that's passive income. And the IRS says, look, you can have passive losses, but we're only going to allow you to utilize them against passive income. If you have say $50,000 of passive losses and only $40,000 of passive income, you're going to have $10,000 of losses that you weren't able to use this year that you're going to have to carry forward into a year where you have passive income to offset it. And So that's one of the things that you, when you're, before you go ahead and have to do a cost segregation study, you want to make sure that you actually can utilize the losses that they're going to generate. Because there's another portion that we haven't really gotten into called bonus depreciation, where not only can you allocate parts of the cost into these shorter life buckets, anything that is less than 20 years is eligible for, well, there's, if it's an eligible asset, it's eligible for what's called bonus depreciation. And what bonus depreciation is it's a something in the code that allows you to utilize more of the cost of an asset, depreciate more of the cost in the first year that it's put in service than normally you could do otherwise. So if you it used to be 50%. So if you bought, if you had an eligible asset that you bought for $1,000, you could bonus depreciate 50% of that in the first year that it's in service. In 2017, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act came into play. And after, I think, September of 2017, assets that went into that were considered eligible for bonus depreciation were 100% depreciated. Like their bonus depreciation, you could write them the entire thing off. And that 100% bonus depreciation lasted from 2017 until the end of 2022. In 2023, it dropped to 80. In 2024, it drops to 60. And then 40, 20, 0. Until, I think, 2027, it's wiped out completely. Now, why is that important? Well, in our example, if we took that 30% cost segregation number, which I think in our example, it was like $82,000. When we did the math, that was, and you bonus depreciated that at 60% for 2024, that generated a $62,000 depreciation number, which when we go back to where we started with those $10,000 as our first, the asset itself, we created another $52,000 of depreciation that we could, in essence, utilize against other passive income. But again, if you don't have the if you don't have the ability to utilize the loss, is it really worth doing the cost segregation study, right? And there's a few ways to kind of mitigate that and actually use those losses. But generally speaking, you're going to be stuck using passive losses against passive income. So if you don't have other rental income, or if you don't have like a K-1, for say you were a silent partner in a restaurant where you invested money, but you get a K-1, and maybe that K-1 comes in, that would be considered passive. That would be passive income you could utilize that depreciation against. But you just want to make sure that you have the ability to use those losses in order to actually benefit from the cost seg study.
Okay. And I assume that, you know, by accelerating the depreciation and doing this cost seg study, assuming that you do it on the right property and it makes sense and you have losses to offset, the impact is really that because you can depreciate more, you're essentially keeping more money in your pocket. Less money is paid out to taxes, right? So that's the whole purpose behind doing it.
Absolutely. Whole purpose behind doing it. Yes. And what, you know, in that presentation, we had an example of, you know, if you had $80,000 of rental income that came in, and I think we had $18,000 of operational expenses. Okay, so we had net income of $62,000. So $62,000 went into our account. We would have had to pay tax on that $62,000. But when we did the full boat cost seg study with the accelerated depreciation, we wiped out all of that. We had a $62,000 expense to utilize against that net income. So we had $62,000 that we didn't have to pay any tax on because we wiped it out with the depreciation from the cost segregation study. So yes, you have more, it really becomes a sort of a velocity of money situation where you're keeping more money in-house. So instead of paying whatever your tax rate was going to be on that $62,000, you now have access to all of that to put into different avenues to grow even more and even faster because you have a longer control over that money that you otherwise would have sent to the IRS.
Okay. Are there any potential downsides or risk associated with cost seg studies that investors should be aware of?
The main one is just making sure that if you're going to spend the money on it, because they can range from, you know, I don't know, maybe $1,500 to $5,000 or $10,000 for a full-blown cost segregation study. You just want to make sure that you're going to actually be able to utilize the losses. It's not like a red flag for audit, but you just want to make sure that you can use the losses and that whoever's doing them is reputable. And I can send you some, I mentioned the online company that does them. I'm in a tax advisor network. We have access to another company. I think they're called Cost Segregation Authority. They're pretty solid as well.
Okay.
But that's a company that will actually send somebody to your property to do the full study.
I would assume there's a little bit of risk on somebody that wants to do it themselves, right? I assume that there's a little bit of risk. Yeah.
If you're doing it yourself, it's just not, the IRS does not consider that, dependable is not the word, but they don't consider it reliable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another nice thing that happens when you have a cost segregation study is because, remember, we talked about how the study will line item out all the different components of the property. Oftentimes, if, when you have a rental property, you replace something. You're basically adding more, you're adding the cost of the new, like a roof or whatever that you're adding to it, right? So you have a new asset to depreciate. But technically, because you're removing the old part, you should get the full expense at that time, right? That is very difficult if you don't know what that actual component of the building is worth, right? The cost segregation study gives you line item by line item of all the different parts of the building. So when you replace that cabinet, you know exactly what the cost is because you have a cost segregation study to back you up. So if there's like $300 or $400 left on that cabinet that you're replacing, you can depreciate that $300 or $400 in the year that it's replaced. You don't have to wait and depreciate anymore.
Okay. So when is the best time to conduct a cost segregation study? Is it like right after you acquire a property? Is it after you do some renovations, or is it at some other point in time?
If I know that I'm going to do some work to the property, I'll wait until the property's done to get the whole thing done. Now, that's my opinion, is the best time to do that.
Right after you do work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're looking for a cost seg firm to do the work, how important is it to really talk to people and ask around? Is it pretty much a dime a dozen, or is it, you really can find a bad one out there?
You could find a bad one. I would probably, there's only really one that I recommend that's an online service. The rest I would probably talk to tax accountants that are involved in real estate that work with firms that do them. I would feel more comfortable I'm comfortable with who I recommend. Mm-hmm. If somebody said, hey, do you know that, Joe's cost seg company? I probably wouldn't recommend them. Because it's not one of those things where I'm going to say it doesn't matter. Just go with them. They're fine. I would want somebody that has a track record of, number one, not being questioned by the IRS, and if they do, a winning track record of being able to support the study that they've done.
Okay. So, do you see any major differences in the benefits of a cost seg study if you're comparing like residential to commercial to industrial? Is there any big difference between all of them, or is it relatively the same as far as the benefits and reasons to do them?
That's a tough question because there's a lot of intricacies behind the scenes. Obviously, if you have a rental property in the middle of the city that you bought for $50,000 and you put 12 into it, it's probably not worth doing a cost segregation study. I think for it, there's a lot of value. I probably more value in bigger commercial type properties. But again, if you're buying rental properties, it's always worth doing that. One of the ways around having to deal with that passive income limitation is something we call the short-term rental loophole. And what that is essentially, if you buy a property that you're going to rent for 7 days or less on average, there's different rules for passive income. I don't go down too far down the rabbit hole too far on the short-term rental loophole, but suffice to say that it's a way where you can actually complete a cost segregation study, generate those big losses, and use them against other types of income, right? So So basically what I was saying was that commercial generally gets a bigger bang for the buck. But if you're going to use something like the short-term rental loophole, then by all means, use them for your rental properties. Like we have a lot of times what we see is we'll have high W-2 clients who will buy a short-term rental every year, right? Because what they'll do is they'll get the short-term rental. They'll make sure that they qualify as a short-term rental, and they'll utilize the cost segregation study on that property against their W-2 income that year. And then the next year just convert it to a regular rental. And they'll do that every year. And that's totally fine. You can do that. There are scenarios where possibly doing it on residential rentals is, you know, you get just as much bang for the buck if you're able to generally use those, you know, that those losses. You know, in other ways that you can use, so we have the short-term rental loophole. If you qualify as a real estate professional, if you have other passive income that you want to utilize the losses against, if you do what we kind of call the lazy 1031 exchange, where you don't go through the real process of a full 1031, you have a property you sold, you made some profit, and then you have the losses from the cost seg on another property, they can wash each other. And then there's the active participation, which it's basically, if you make $100,000 or less and you actively participate in your rental properties, you can deduct up to $25,000 of passive losses against your other income. Now, that $25,000 allowance gets reduced a dollar for every $2 over $100,000. So once you get to $150,000, you phased it out completely. But that's another way. And the reason that the difference between active participation and, say, material is it's a lot easier to actively participate in your rental property. So those are generally the four or five main ways around the passive income limitations, which if you can hit those, they actually, you know, obviously then doing it for a rental property is a solid play.
Okay. Are there any IRS specific guidelines or regulations that govern these cost seg studies?
No, there are audit guides on how to have them done. They're on, if you go to irs.gov, they're in there. You can just look for cost segregation audit guide, and it gives you this, you know, what they look for when they, you know, when they're going out to verify. You know, the things that you just have to look for are like the section 469, which is the passive loss limitations. You want to make sure that you're not, you know, you can, again, utilize the losses against some sort of passive income. Otherwise, they just get suspended. You don't lose them. They're just suspended until you have either you have rental, you have other passive income to utilize them against it, or you sell the property, in which case then you can take the losses that were hanging out there.
The episode will continue in just a moment.
As an investor, we know it's important to stay on top of market trends and real estate opportunities that add value to your portfolio. We also know that having a trusted source of reliable information to help you stay a step ahead of other investors is critical to your success. If you're interested in having these types of resources, as well as access to me and my team, I invite you to join the Empire Investment Club, a free service that gives you an easier way to make sense of today's and tomorrow's real estate opportunities. As a member of the Empire Investment Club, you'll get access to relevant resources and investment-focused experiences such as live interactive webinars, market trend presentations, and investor socials designed to equip you with what you need to succeed. So whether you're an active investor, passive investor, a combination of both, or just starting out, the club is where you'll get what you need to build a portfolio you love. To join, just head over to jenniferdejesus.com, sign up, and we'll see you in the club, where everyone's on a journey to becoming a better investor.
What documentation or records should investors be maintaining to support the cost seg study in case of an audit?
Well, it's pretty much like anything else. Like I keep records of everything, keep receipts for everything. And it doesn't mean you have to have a shoebox full of receipts. Like take a picture, keep it in your QuickBooks. You know, you can do things like that, but you definitely want to have backup for your backup. You know, they're not messing around. They're really looking for people that are kind of trying to play the system. So it's very important that you document everything. You could keep spreadsheets, but obviously the receipts are what's going to matter. You know, invoices for work done, HUD, you know, closing documents, those types of things.
Okay. Should you ever update a cost seg study? Like, does it ever have to be updated or reviewed?
No, because once it's done, it's kind of done. Yeah. And here's the other thing. You don't necessarily, for people that are just hearing about this now and are like, oh, you know what, in 2022, I could have used this. You can do a cost seg study on a property you bought in a prior year. Okay. So the IRS has these kind of like little rules that they were basically where you, if you're going to do a cost segregation study on a property that you had from a prior year that you already did your return and all that type of thing, you don't have to go and amend those returns. This is what's considered an accounting method change. So there's a form 3115, and that form allows you to go back, do the cost segregation study, get all the allocation for the depreciation, and then you use it in this year that you're doing, that you're filling out that new form. So it's not something where you have to go back and amend your tax return, but you can actually go back and create a cost seg for a prior year property.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So how does somebody put, how does cost segregation fit into like an overall investment strategy? How should investors be utilizing this as they're preparing to grow their wealth, right? How often should they be using it? And, you know, just how does it fit in to that overall strategy?
I think if you're not a real estate professional, okay, number one, if you're a real estate professional, the reason that term is so important is because the IRS says if you're a real estate professional, you don't got to worry about the passive loss rules. You can use all your losses from your rental properties against whatever income you have. But that's it's sort of a high bar to meet. There's just a lot of hours you have to meet. I don't want to get into it. We can. There's a lot of requirements involved in becoming a quote unquote real estate professional. So some of these other things that we discussed, like the short-term rental loophole, that is one where, and you know, we do that for high income taxpayers that don't necessarily have a lot of other stuff going on, like doctors, for instance. Like if they have a $500,000 W-2, $1 million W-2, they don't have the time to say, look, I'm a real estate professional. They're cranking out that W-2 all year.
Right.
So that is a situation where incorporating a short-term rental into their tax planning strategy is a solid way to allocate some of these losses against that W-2 income. Or can they get their spouse to qualify as a real estate professional? If they can do that, same thing. Then they can get regular rental properties. They don't have to worry about short-terming anything. They can just do the cost segregation study on an apartment building they bought. So yeah, it's definitely something we look at. We like to, you know, you want to take a look at all the different, like we use this thing called the trifecta, where we kind of put all your operations over here, your assets over here, and say, okay, how do we mix these two together? We want to keep a dividing line in between them, but how do we do things here that benefit over here and vice versa? It's an in-depth way of looking at the overall scenario to see how and if a cost segregation study would actually benefit a person.
It sounds to me, though, like it is really, really critical to have a good CPA or tax advisor that is helping you plan for these things in advance.
For sure. Like one of the things that we, you know, like I mentioned earlier, is you can't tax plan in reverse. Like it's not a retrofit kind of thing. Once there are some things you can do like after the 31st, but it's few and far between. So it's very important that if tax planning is something that you want to utilize, you need to work with somebody. And we're not saying like every day, you know, there's situations where, you know, monthly is a good idea to meet. Quarterly is a great time to meet. But it's very difficult to do anything that can profoundly impact your cash flow and your tax burden after the year's over. So yes, long-winded answer to yes, it's very important to work with somebody throughout the year versus kind of waiting and hoping your tax prep person can make the adequate changes. There's just really nothing they can change. You're just handing them the information at that point and saying, you know, run with it.
Sure. Can you use cost segregation studies in conjunction with other tax strategies like 1031 exchanges and, you know, if you're investing in opportunity zones and different things like that?
Yeah, you can. And again, the biggest benefit from the cost segregation study is that depreciation. I just wanted to kind of hit one of the, it's not a bad part of cost segregation. It's just something to consider. So there's something called depreciation recapture. right? So what that means is that when you have these assets that you've cost segged or even just regular depreciated over the years, when you sell that asset, the government says, look, we gave you a tax deduction all these years for that fake paper expense. Now we're going to make you recapture it as income. So, and it depending on the type of asset, it kind of can get a little bit complicated, but that's just something to contend with, that when you're setting up your plan, it's part of the discussion to say, look, how long do you plan on holding these? Are you going to sell them in 5 or 10 years? And then you have to plan for that depreciation recapture down the road, right? So I just wanted to mention that. That's definitely something you want to consider when you're looking at whether or not to do one of these.
Okay.
Because and again, the reason is because if you have to recapture the depreciation, if you've done a cost segregation study, you've taken a lot of that depreciation early on. So there's a larger bucket to recapture when you sell, right? So that's...
Understood. So, yeah. But you can use it in conjunction with other things, right? Like the 1031 exchange,
sure.
And potentially defer. Okay. So how do you see the upcoming election impacting these tax strategies? Or, you know, are they not? Could they not? You know, what do you see as kind of the writing on the wall, at least for 2024?
Okay. So one thing's for sure. And I'm not going to go down a
political rabbit hole.
I'm not going to put on a MAGA hat or something, but you know, so honestly, because my view is I'm economically driven. Like what I think is best for small business is what I lean towards. So one of the things that has been that Biden has talked about is that he wants to completely eliminate the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, which a lot of these things are considered, they're set to sunset, which means they're only temporary, but in order for them to continue, they have to get reauthorized. And what that means is if he lets everything sunset, everybody's taxes are going up. All the tax brackets are going up. Some things are good. The SALT tax, which was basically the like state and local tax, real estate taxes, that was limited to $10,000. So areas that had high real estate taxes or high local income taxes and state income taxes, they kind of got hosed with the SALT because they were limited to 10 grand. They couldn't do anything with whatever was above that. So a lot of those things are going to change. A lot of people's taxes are going to go up, whether or not they make above 400 grand or not. With respect to some of these things that we're talking about, there's talks about increasing capital gains tax. There's talks about taxing book income, which is really strange because book income. So without getting too far into the nerd weeds, there's book income and taxable income. So book income is like for you and your investors and, you know, look how great we are. Taxable income is like, look how terrible things are. We're utilizing all these tax, we're utilizing a tax code to make it look like we're making no money, right? Which is totally cool. It's totally great. I mean, that's why the tax code's there, to incentivize people to do things, right? So if you're taxing book income, regardless, what's the point in having taxable income? Like there's some strange things there that I think are problematic. They want to limit 1031 exchanges. I don't know if it was 500,000 or something. Like they wanted to limit the amount of capital gains that you could defer using the 1031, which kind of destroys a lot of the reason the 1031 is there, right? So that I think that's terrible. There's talk about taxing unrealized gains, which is, I mean, imagine I have this pen, right? And this pen I bought for a dollar like 40 years ago, and now it's worth $100 million. I'm not selling it. It's just worth $100 million. Well, do I have to pay tax on that $100 million? What if I pay tax on the $100 million and tomorrow it drops to $2? Like, so there's a lot of things that I hate about what could happen after this next election, tax-wise. And that's just a part of what the Biden administration is proposing. Now, will all of those things happen? Who knows? It depends. If there's a balance between both parties, maybe not. Maybe we're okay. Maybe they do some modifications to it. One thing that they never discuss is the spending side. They never want to discuss cutting spending, which in my view is where all the problems are, right? Who cares how much revenue you're bringing in if you're just going to print more money because it's still not enough.
Right.
Like we absolutely can't stop spending. So no matter what they do tax-wise, we can't keep up. So, you know, that's sort of my ridiculous soapbox that I get on. But I think there's a lot of bad things that are tax-wise that are being proposed. I don't think all of them will get through, you know, depending on how the balance of power is, like I said, but, you know, who knows? I think I've seen a lot of bad tax proposals and legislation get through now. When an administration doesn't have to worry about being reelected, I can't imagine it getting better. You know, so,
yeah,
you know, we'll see.
So what would you tell investors to do now, right? Would you say, look, if you were planning to do a 1031, do it now because it might not be around? Would you, you know, would there be any specific advice specific to 2024 that you'd be giving people in lieu of?
I would say it's specific, but it's kind of generalized. I would say if you've only worked with a tax preparer, stop doing that. Like call them and say, hey, can we start doing some tax planning throughout the year? Like, to me, the only way to there's so little that we can do, you know, with what's going on in DC. Like, we can't make them not do some of these things, but we can prepare as much as we can. We can start laying the groundwork to be proactive in our tax strategy versus reactive. That's the big that's what motivates, you know, my firm is that. I'm so tired of just seeing people sit back and just allowing this to go on. Like, let's use the code the way it was intended. Like, the code is there specific. There's no loopholes, right? The code is there to say, look, do this and do this and do this, and we're going to give you tax incentives to do it. So let's do that. You know, get with a tax advisor. Don't just sit and wait and think a tax prepper or H&R Block or somebody down like next April is going to be able to go and fix anything. It's too late then. You know, we're, you know, midway through the year, just get active in your own tax planning.
Awesome. So do you have any recommended resources, books, tools that investors that want to learn more about CostSeg and just some of these tax strategies can kind of dive into?
I would, if for CostSeg specific, there's not a lot out there. I would probably say, go to the IRS website, look up the cost segregation audit guide. For tax planning, I can recommend the Tax and Legal Playbook by Mark Kohler. That is he's a CPA and a tax attorney, which is like a nerd to the like infinity power. But he puts it in a way that is understandable. That really is like it's not difficult to understand, and he's so excited about the small business, the small business entrepreneur and like the American dream, like that. That's who he's who I was certified through, and I'm telling you, it's just nice to have somebody who is a master at this stuff, and is as excited as you are about it, right? So yeah, so I would say Mark Kohler's Tax and Legal Playbook. He's got a couple other books. All stuff is good. We do a lot of strategies around like self-directed IRAs and what you can do with those. Matt Sorensen is another guy who has he runs a company, I believe it's called Self-Directed IRA. Those are pretty powerful. Like, people don't know that you can invest if you have a self-directed IRA, like you can invest in anything you want. You could flip houses in your IRA if you wanted to, you know, like, so there's a lot of cool things that people can do that are kind of outside the traditional knowledge base of what's out there. Like, you don't have to just buy some mutual funds. You can do a lot of cool things in a self-directed manner. So yeah, so I would look at those two guys. They're really solid. Yeah, but I'm kind of biased because I have meetings with them throughout the week. So. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So is there any questions, Mike, that I didn't ask you that you wish I would have?
I You know, this is, I love cost segregation studies. I think if we did a second, if I did a second, a part two of the presentation, I think I would do a deeper dive into some of those ways around being limited to utilizing them, like maybe do a deep dive into short-term rentals, into reps, the real estate professionals. Like, I think that would probably be a good supplement to, you know, to what we did the first time.
Well, then it sounds like I'm going to have you back, not only for our podcast, but also for our in-person networking events. So
I love it.
A deal to me. I like it a lot.
All right. All right. I'm in.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for your time today. I truly appreciate all your insight and all your tips and tricks, and heard you loud and clear that it's time to be proactive about your tax planning strategies. Yeah. For sure.
It is. It is.
Thank you for listening to my episode with Mike Hettinger, Certified Tax Advisor. I hope you enjoyed our discussion on cost segregation studies and how tax planning can benefit you in the long run. Most importantly, I hope you heard some tips and tricks to make sure that you save some of those tax dollars and keep it right back in your pocket. Until next time, take care.
For more information about how Jennifer can help you plan, develop, and manage a strong real estate investment portfolio, visit growingempires.com.